Blog Talk Radio.
Your Blog Talk Radio program. I'm your host, Susan Laris and Danz, and today we have a really unique and interesting guest on the show today. I'm really excited today to be welcoming world record-breaking skier and mountain climber Jan Reynolds, who is also an award-winning author and a prize-winning photojournalist, and she has a new book out called High Altitude Woman, From Extreme Sports to Indigenous Cultures, Discovering the Power of the Feminine. And Jan has had absolutely amazing experiences worldwide, which not only reflect a life that is really interesting for many of us to see if we haven't participated in extreme adventures, but also reflect the power of the human spirit and how we all work together, the subtleties of the human spirit. And that is what I so appreciate about her work and her life. Just telling you a little bit more about Jan, she was often the only woman on expeditions to every livable continent, and she is a medal winner in the World Cup Biathlon, and she's the holder of a number of high-altitude skiing and mountain climbing records. She really is a pioneer who has laid the groundwork and opened the door for a lot of women today who participate in extreme sports, and also women who are participating in life in many ways, who bring themselves fully to the table in what they do. And she is very much an advocate of these powerful feminine strengths of compassion, mediation, cooperation, and observation, which are really accessible to both men and women. It's really an honor to have Jan on the show today because she's appeared on many, many programs. She has been on ABC's Good Morning America. She's been on the NBC Today Show, NPR. She's been in adventure films. Her work has been featured in many magazines such as the New York Times, the National Geographic, Vogue, many more. She has lectured worldwide. And her website is janreynolds.com, and I invite you to visit that. It is accessible from the show page if you are able to see the page. I know many of you listen to this show in different ways. And I am going to open up a live chat room here in a minute so that if you have comments and questions while we're talking, I welcome you there as well. So without further delay, I am just so happy to welcome Jan to the Frontier Beyond Fear. Hello, Jan.
Hi there. It's great to be here.
Well, I really have to say, your book is such an inspiration, as is your life, but it's the subtleties that really come out, too, just the subtleties in human behavior. And I really appreciate how you are surfacing that for all of us to better understand.
Well, I wasn't really sure how people would react to or respond to the book, because when you're writing something, you're in your own world, and putting things down. And I've been quite surprised now that the book's out. It's been out only about 2 months. And the feedback has been that people really like it, and they actually think it's a page-turner. So it really surprised me, because I'm thinking, well, you know, there's a lot of climbing in here and perhaps a lot of things that people don't relate to.
Yes.
The average person. So I didn't know if they would think it was kind of like snore boring, but that's not the response I get. So you're telling me, which thank you very much, I'm flattered, you're saying that some of the subtleties and the things I noticed and that I responded to on my expeditions come through in the book.
Yes. Well, you've given us a glimpse into a world that many of us have never seen. And so to me, I mean, your book is very much, I've been studying the art of memoir writing lately, and actually what you did is perfect. I mean, to give
really?
Us that kind of rich detail.
Really? Well, anyhow, I when you're on an expedition, so for some of the people out there who don't know what we're talking about, when I say expedition, I mean we are setting records. We're going somewhere in the mountains, in particular on the expeditions I was on. It could be the ocean, could be the desert, but largely I'm in the high mountains in the Himalaya. And I'm working with only two or three other men, and they're some of, well, the best in the world at that time. So we have this little microcosm of guys with one girl, and we're all working together as a team, and we are in life and death situations, and we have been literally hanging off cliffs. We've had avalanches, you know, everything you can imagine that can happen on a peak happened to us in one form or another. So what I found really interesting was how I saw the event and how I responded and how the men saw the event and how they responded. And even though I was younger than I am now, going through that, I really experienced the difference in the way men and women think, speak, and behave. And it's a great thing that we're different. And I just think it's helpful to acknowledge those differences.
Yes, yes. I wonder if you could start us out with giving us a glimpse into how did you get started on this path? Because it seems like it does take a certain type of spirit to really be so expansive in the way that you were getting started out on this more adventurous path so that you could put yourself into these situations.
You know, I think everybody is just as expansive, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe what you're asking about is how did I find a way to find out more of who I am, what I want, what
yes.
I feel I have to give, and how did I tap into that to be able to get
exactly.
to those places? And I don't think there's anything unique or special about me. I think that this was just sort of the way I was. I can remember even before I went to school, and I was sent to a private Catholic school, and I went there for a while before the public school. So there was no kindergarten. I must have been 4 or 5 years old, and I could remember that far back. And I remember riding in the truck with my dad, and I was number 6 of 7 kids on a dairy farm in Middlebury, Vermont. So I had a pretty basic upbringing, one of many, on a dairy farm. But I can remember, even before I went to school, this whole thing about men and women, it even was in my mind then, when you're kind of a neuter at 4 years old. But I remember riding in the truck with my dad, seeing his life, what he did, where he went, and he took the truck to get fixed, and when he saw his buddy Leonard to fix the truck, and how they laughed, and all the things he had to do for work, which was quite physical, but he was outside. I responded to that. And then when I'd be with my mother and when she was with the other women, it always seemed like the women were always harried and they were always like feeling like, oh, so many kids in the way and this and that. And I made mental choice at that age. I said, I want my dad's life. And I'm a mom. I have kids and I love them dearly and they're both boys.
Yeah.
But I think even as a very small child, I saw that it was important to me, even though I was female, it was okay that I could be physical, I could do hard work, I could hang with the guys. It's just something that meant more to me. Now, a lot of other little girls would have thought, perhaps I don't want to get that dirty, I don't want to work that hard, you know, whatever. But I just think it's really important for people to, where they are now in life, to really look at themselves and what makes and helps them resonate. And also, if you have kids and little kids, really watch and see what they respond to and resonate with. And so, I don't know if I've really answered your question, but when I grew up, because I'm pushing 60 now, when I was younger, women weren't doing this. They're all doing it now, but they weren't doing those things when I was younger. There weren't women, not very many anyway, climbing at the level that I was. And I even soloed the Grand Teton, which is a hard rock climb, which, you know, back then a 5.9, if anyone out there is a climber, it was called a 5.9 because that was supposedly the hardest climb a human could climb. And I ended up doing that without a rope because I was with a guy, and I don't recommend ever climbing that hard without a rope. It's not smart or sane. But my point was, doing those, you know, being outside, being physical, doing those kinds of things with guys was just my nature. And somehow I was able to tap into that early enough. And it could have been because being very physical, even when I was in high school, I started ski racing, and then I raced at a national level. So I, even when I was young, I had that physical training that gave me a great base to be physically strong. And I'm not that big. You know, when I was setting these records and whatnot with men, I was about 135 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, I just, as we got higher and higher in elevation, I did better and better. So there was an equalizer, some of the bigger guys, 170, 180 pounds. And I carried the same loads they did. But at altitude, if I'm doing better than they are, then that can be an equalizer.
Yes. Yeah, there's something interesting that you observe at one point in your book about how women often have a tendency to pass up opportunities if they just don't think, they seem to sometimes lack confidence. And whereas men are more aggressive, even if... you know, I think you talk about false notions. Even if they're basing a position based on false notions, they will still, they'll push through a lot of times.
Yeah.
And I felt this was a really important point that you raised. And
well, you really tapped into something that's important to me, thanks for giving me a chance to talk about it, because social scientists have collected the data and analyzed it. And, for example, a test was given to both men and women. And when they interviewed the men and women afterwards, the men, for the most part, almost 2-1, all guessed, estimated that they got a higher score than they actually did, and every woman, almost 2-1, estimated their score was lower than what they actually got.
Uh-huh.
And so this is what I would do if I could do anything with my book, is be that voice in every woman's and little girl's ear saying, you can do this, you've got this, you know you do, and just step forward. And because the social scientists have also found through collecting data that if a woman is given clear and specific feedback, positive feedback about whatever job she's doing, mine was in the mountains, it could be collecting data itself. If a woman is given clear and precise positive feedback, she will have as much confidence as the male in whatever job they're doing. It's just our makeup, our chemicals, our hormones. They're in our brains, and they create the way we respond as a whole, as a gender, generally, to the world. so I could jump around. There's so many things I would say about this, but to get back to what you were talking about, that's really very key, because women have something that's called an internalized barrier. This is what some of the professionals are calling it. So women if they have a failure, they tend to blame themselves. They say it's for because of lack of ability. And if they have a success, they say, well, you know, that was luck. Men, in general, attribute success to their own abilities. Yeah, I did it. You know, I'm there because I did it. And then they will blame external forces for a failure. So now social scientists gather data and make these statements. So that wasn't my job. I worked with that data to just take a look at my personal experiences and then look at this data that's been gathered and how social scientists see that men and women respond. And so you're right on with that one. And the main thing is that women and girls just need, the other thing was, another test was taken, and it was a math test, and they had a harsh male hand out the test, and literally the female scored a little lower. When they had a woman hand out the test that looked at all the little girls in the eyes and said, okay, here you go, you've got this, you can do this, here's your math test, and hand it to the boys as well, the girls scored higher. So in many different ways, in different tests that these social scientists have run men and women and girls and boys through, they keep getting that same feedback. And that's what I want to do here and in this world is be that voice. If women and girls hear that clear feedback that you're really doing a good job, you're on it, you've got it, you can do this, then they do, and they do it really well.
Yes. You know, as you're talking, I cannot help but see the parallels in women in engineering fields. And, in fact, I had to smile. I tweeted about this show, and immediately someone who's fairly outspoken in that domain picked up the tweet and favorited it, who is a woman in engineering.
Awesome.
Yes, yes. And,
awesome.
And it's very similar because, you know, I came from that world, so it was a different kind of thing, and yet I feel like when I was young, and I imagine you may have encountered this as well, we were discouraged. I was actually told not to go into math. I ended up getting a math degree, but a man told me not to do it, a guidance counselor. And I wonder, turning this, and nowadays we tend to encourage women more, which is really important, but how should women respond if they do still get that discouragement of, oh, you know, maybe you should really consider doing something else because, you know, and that can still happen in the world. And how do we respond when that occurs? How do we push through? And does it make some of us almost want to push through it even more if someone's discouraging us?
Well, I think this is the kind of thing where knowing your own self as well as you can is your best advocate. Because I wouldn't say I always knew exactly just what I wanted to do in the world and when, but I always seemed to know what I didn't want to do or what I just couldn't do. And I think we're people, men and women, but we're talking about women here specifically, but it applies to both.
Yeah.
I think when people really try to push themselves into arenas and places that really aren't them, on a deeper level, that they pay for it and they suffer it in the end. And I think it will come to bear and come to the fore that that's not really who they are on a deeper level. And I'd have to say a funny story, and you have to realize how old I am. I'm in my 58th year. I say pushing 60. But my mother, and she's a wonderful woman, smart, strong. She was married to the farmer, and they had 7 kids, so she was very busy at home and raising the kids and all kinds of things like that. So I'm one of the ones at the end, and I'm a little rambunctious, and I'm in high school, and she looks at me, and she goes, you know, she sees I'm pretty physical, and I'm out there, whatever. You get the picture.
Yeah.
And she said, now, why don't you take shorthand and typing? You know, it's a good idea to have that, and then, you know, you can always fall back on that and you can get a job.
Uh-huh.
Well, I was a straight-A student, and I did it for my mother, and I really tried. I didn't do this to rebel. I got C's. I could not read my shorthand. Everyone, even when I write normally, longhand. People can't read it. My mother joked afterwards. She said, you should have been a doctor. I can't read your writing. And I said, yeah, well, you should try reading my shorthand. And in typing, I was fast, but I would make so many mistakes. It just wasn't natural for me.
Yeah.
So I was a straight-A student. It brought my grades down. I still got into the college I wanted. But I remember looking at my mom saying, you know what, Mom, I wouldn't want to be the secretary. I'd want to be the boss. And I didn't mean like, oh, I should be the boss, not the secretary. I just meant that's naturally the way I am, the way I, what I gravitate to. When I was doing things, I ended up captain of every sport, but it was just, I'm a natural organizer, I guess. And I did that on expeditions. So I went through what you're talking about, and it was even my own mother saying, uh-huh. you know, you should do these things so you could always get a job. I never would have gotten a job. I would have been fired as a secretary. I'd be telling my boss what I'd observed and what I think would be a better thing to do, and he'd probably fire me for that reason. So, you know, I guess the best advice is what I said in the beginning of this long-winded answer is the best thing you can do for yourself is really know yourself. Know what makes you tick. Know what makes you smile. Know what makes you go that extra distance to do, because that's something you have a natural bent for. And sometimes it's hard to stick with that. Trust me, I've had my downtimes that are financially difficult or physically difficult, but it has always paid off for me to stick with who I am.
Yes. Yes. I know, you know, I find it interesting that during the course of your life you discovered the importance of intention and motivation, and yet as a 12-year-old, I want to quote something that you said as a 12-year-old in your book, that your motto, in a sense, was, quote, your life is what you make it, and the world is what it means to you. I find that to be very profound for a 12-year-old, and how you seem to come full circle over time and really come to understand the power of intention. And I'm wondering
right.
if you could reflect on that for us a little bit.
Well, as a 12-year-old, it was more simplistic in that I don't remember what – I wish I could remember what my homework assignment was, because I literally – that's how I knew what age I was and all of that, because I was on my bed doing my homework. And I don't remember the assignment, but I remember thinking this through, and I'm a bit of a thinker anyway. And this may be why it's been easier for me to follow my own lead, because at that young age, and that's even before I'm really developing into a woman and all that, so I'm still
yeah.
kind of that kid, and I'm thinking, you know, your life is what you make it. It was at that point in time I realized, you know, we are the sum of our choices. I'm going to be what I choose. And then, granted, we don't know what's going to happen to us, but we can keep making choices. And we can choose. One of the most powerful things, I think, in this world is choosing how to respond to a negative event. Now, I didn't think this through as a 12-year-old. I took it simplistically. I just said, your life is what you make it.
Yeah.
And then the world is what it means to you. Well, to me, the world was a big, wide adventure. To someone else, the world could be a place to make a bunch of money. To someone else, the world could be family and connection and being, you know, close to your siblings and creating another family as soon as you're an adult, you know. So
yes.
So I looked at it. So you can see the difference there. You know, your life is what you make it, and then the world is what it means to you. And that freed me up to make those choices. And, of course, all kinds of things happen to you in your life, so you make your choices, and then what transpires. And if it's something negative, and I'm repeating myself here on purpose so that anyone listening can really think about that, that one of the most powerful things is how you choose to respond to those negative events.
Yes.
And that's a very important and powerful choice in your life, and how you move forward and how you gain strength and how you gain insight. So yes, we are the sum of those choices. And it's not as if you can say, well, Well, let's just say sometimes fate takes a hand, and we have made a choice to be or do something, and then we have to just respond to what actually transpires. And then I think I know what you're talking about in terms of come full circle, because it's very interesting being that young child at the private Catholic school who ends up going over to the Himalaya and spends time in the Buddhist culture with the Sherpas and the Tibetans.
Yes.
And people know much more about this now because of the Dalai Lama and his teachings, and he won the Nobel Prize. But when I went there, people didn't really even, you know, we're talking 20, 30 years ago, people didn't really know or understand the Dalai Lama and Tibetan Buddhism and whatnot. So when I came in contact with that, and when I had a Sherpa translator on a different cultural project I was working on for National Geographic, translated for me what a monk that I found that was basically living in a cave. It was a big rock with a rock pile around it, and he had a fire, and he had someone there tending the fire and making tea, and he was wrapped to be warm. When I asked him, you know, I said, well, what do you think of our culture, the Western cultures that are coming over to visit in this area of the world now? And he looked at me, and then he spoke in his Tibetan language that was translated for me. He said, well, you know, you're all good people and it's fine, but you're young, you're immature. You think what you do is important. And he said, it's not what you do that is important. It's what your intention is when you do it.
Yeah.
That's important. And I thought about that for years and years and years and years. And let's say your action, I was going to use this as an example just because I was at the private Catholic school, and they would pass the basket at church down the down the aisle. And so people would put their money in. Let's just say for some people, maybe they are doing it because they want people to think they're wealthy or that they're giving away a lot. And so their intention is very different than the person who is dropping money. They could care less if anyone could see how much it was. They're giving it because they know specifically where it's going. You know, that's one example of trying to say what's most important is your intention. And I'm trying to make it simple, and I'm making it more complicated
here. You're explaining it very well, actually.
When I came full circle, what I'm talking about is we are the sum of our choices.
Yes.
What I've had to do in life is have an intention in mind, take that action, and then what you have to do then is let go. The Buddhists would call it non-attachment. And that doesn't mean that you don't care anymore. Your strong intention with love, I'm trying to think of an example. Let's say there's a book I really want to write. Let's say it has something to do with supporting girls and helping them feel their own power and strength. This is all hypothetical. So that's my intention when I do the proposal for the book and I send it to the publisher. And at that point, what I have to do is let go.
Yeah.
Because my intention is to help girls, and they may take it, I may make my living that way, or they may not take it. And that is what's very important. That's how you make your choice, that's how you're the sum of your choices. And it could be that's how I respond to a negative event if they say no. Maybe then I decide I'd rather do a small YouTube movie and put it up. Maybe that will affect more girls, if you see what I'm saying.
Yes,
I'm
yes.
trying to illustrate everything I've been talking about, that we're the sum of our choices, and then our powers and how we choose to respond to negative events. And what's really key in life is your intention, not what you do, but what your intention is when you do it. That's where the power and the strength is.
Yes, yes, and I feel that's an important lesson that it's coming through multiple guests on this show, and we can't repeat it enough, just how powerful that is, and how people seem to come to this conclusion in different ways, which to me is the inspiration of spirit and the universe, that, you know, we if we're open, we're guided to this truth. And I appreciate how you were in a time, like you said, you know, nowadays we hear all kinds of concepts within different Eastern religions, which back then, not necessarily. I mean, not as directly as you did. And perhaps this is a good time to talk a little bit about your Vanishing Culture children's series and just in general, the wisdom that comes from these indigenous cultures that you study. And I'll reflect on one thing that's in your book that kind of made me smile, how when you first had a child, how you brought your child everywhere, and you talk about how, well, you know, in a lot of other cultures, the kids are right with the mothers, you know, they're carrying them around doing whatever they're doing. And I found that to be interesting, how you connected. So if you could just reflect on that a little bit, I think that's a powerful part of what you bring to the world.
Well, I can talk about a couple of books here. Yes, for the kids, I wrote a series called Vanishing Cultures, and I lived with an indigenous tribe on each continent and wrote about them and photographed them, the Tibetans in the Himalaya, the Tuareg in the Sahara, the Yanomama in the Amazon territory, the Inuit in the Arctic, the Samis for Europe, and so on. And after I had done that book series, that's when I had my first child. After that series was done, living out, you know, hundreds of miles, like with the Yanomama, hundreds of miles in triple canopy jungle is where I'd gotten in on the river. So I then wrote a book called Mother and Child, and I think that touches on a lot of what you were speaking about. And when I had my child, having lived with these indigenous cultures, it gave me the freedom to really feel like I could go anywhere and do anything with my child, because I had seen little kids wrapped in yak blanket carpets and tied on yak backs, and they went over 20,000-foot passes on a salt trade route. I saw babies strapped onto their moms, and they're on camelback crossing the Sahara Desert. There's no water, there's no food, you know. I was in the Arctic in igloos where Inuit babies were born. They're born in an igloo, not an ICU. And so that gave me, and granted, I'm sure we have a better infant mortality rate with all the technology we have, and it's a wonderful thing that we have it. But what I received was the freedom to be able to strap my baby on and go anywhere. And people would look at me like, what? And I'd be way out nowhere skiing miles away. But as long as my baby's nursing and is with me, we're fine.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we didn't use baby gates or playpens. We didn't use bottles except for to give my husband a little strength and power. We got the baby to take a bottle. So if I was somewhere and he had the baby, he could give the baby some water and pacify him for a while until I came back. And that's sort of my thing. I was in the guide world. I was trying to help him be in the girl world. So, you know, try to empower him a little bit. But back to, we didn't use, because with indigenous people, they are using playpens or baby gates or bottles. And you take the child with you, and they learn how to stay away from a fire and not get burned. They learn how to go up and down steep inclines. You know, they'll go down backwards. And, you know, I would go to parties sometimes, and sometimes the moms would be freaking out if there weren't baby gates on stairs, and they're afraid their child would fall. Well, if your child's been introduced to all these things, you're just not worried about it.
Yeah.
Or if they aren't crawling yet, they're strapped on with you, you know. So I saw and lived with women who were living the way human beings have lived for hundreds of thousands of years, almost all of time on Earth. The way we live now is such a small, small, infinitesimally small portion of life on Earth that human beings have been here. So by living with all these indigenous people, I had the opportunity to see the really human and natural way women were with their children and how children were raised. And I have to tell you, it was the same way around the world, really. Home births, nursing, babies are strapped on. There was a woman in England who wrote a book called The Continuum Concept, and it became this big concept. And basically all she was doing was what women had done for hundreds of thousands of years, the continuum was when the baby's born, well, it's used to your heartbeat and your warmth, so you should strap it on and walk around with it. Well, that's what women always did, because as soon as they had their babies, they were still integrated in society. They were out in the garden, or they were, you know, digging tubers or whatever, you know, depending on which environment it was, so that it was very natural, if you're still nursing, that your baby's with you.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, as I think about, you know, how we've come to live in our, as parents, even in this society today, and I understand why we want to err on the side of safety sometimes, but we seem to have taken it, you know, kind of reflecting on the theme of this show, you know, we become so fearful of everything, and it gets to the point, even if you put in every possible safety measure in, you know, that you could possibly think of, you're still not going to be in a place where a child is 100% safe all the time. I mean, and so I think that there's a message in what you say. And I grew up in the 70s. I'm about 10 years behind you, but I'm not that young. But I grew up in the 70s when, of course, none of these things existed. We just did what we did. And I'm sure things happen. I mean, there's a balance somewhere, but somewhere we've started limiting ourselves in a way. And even as women, where you are very, you know, you did what you wanted to do and you did it just fine, we tend to limit ourselves sometimes as new mothers, and we don't need to do that. And I'm a mother too, by the way, so
yeah.
I've
yeah.
been through it.
Well, I think my advantage was I literally saw how resilient children are. And not
yeah.
only that, how smart they are. Don't you remember as a little kid and you'd hear parents talking and you'd go, I can't believe they don't know that I'm listening and understand absolutely everything they're saying.
Uh-huh.
And I mean this preschool. And so if we could really remember how smart our kids are and how resilient they are, they're pretty amazing. Yeah, I think I found my children my best teachers if I could just settle down long enough and really take a look at what they were doing or really hear what they were saying. They're pretty amazing little beings. They're more unfettered than we are as adults. And so some of their ideas and thoughts and actions are just, you know, incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's another part of your story. We're going to have to go backwards in time here a little bit because I think it's really significant, actually, is, and you start the book out with this, what your pregnancy was like. And I think maybe that's a perfect place. There are a lot of details in your book, so we'll never be able to get into all the wonderfully rich detail of your adventures. But maybe if you could reflect, again, rewinding before you had a child, on your own pregnancy and what you were doing during your pregnancy, which I find very interesting, and then what happened after you had a baby, and then maybe we can use that to talk a little bit more about, you know, how men and women relate to each other. Bring it.
Right.
So if you could,
right.
if you could describe that as you do in the book, I think that would be a great help to the audience.
Well, I had male doctors, but I had pretty good male doctors. I had already found a midwife, so I was just sticking with her program when I found out I was pregnant, but I did do the official route, and I went to see the doctor, too, and I also went to see a doctor who is a high-altitude specialist because there are problems human beings can have at high altitude, and all of that in combination, even the male doctors, I give them credit, they said to me, well, you know, you can do anything you normally do in pregnancy. Just we don't recommend that people go and do something they haven't done before when they're pregnant. But if these are all the things you normally do, you can go ahead and do them when you're pregnant.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not quite sure they really knew all the things.
Little
that
did
I
they know.
did, but my, you know, my midwife did, and, you know, I didn't really, in my first 3 months, I made sure I had plenty of snack bars with me, but I crossed a portion of the Sahara on camelback with the Tuareg, and, you know, in case we ran out of food or water, I was okay. I didn't really get that sick, so I was fine. And then at 6 months, I climbed and skied a 14,000-foot peak in the Atlas Mountains in Morocco, but I'd been in that region before. And there were some male mountaineers from Europe that didn't make it that day. And when I came down and they found out I was 6 months pregnant, they had to laugh. And, then I was supposed to have flown back before 8 months. You're not supposed to be flying that late. And that, yes, I did. But I was in the Himalaya on a grant, and I did a film. And it was a grant, use it or lose it. So in my seventh and into my 8 months of pregnancy, I was up in the Himalaya shooting video and spending time with my Sherpa and Sherpani friends, but there, I had a ceiling that I didn't go above. And my son now is 19, and he gets straight A's at Rhode Island School of Design, and so I guess it didn't affect his brain.
Uh-huh.
Negatively,
none of that
anyway.
High altitude, yes.
yeah. And so that was my pregnancy. And then I came home because all of my indigenous friends, well, they all obviously all had home births. So I had a midwife, and I had him at home. It was a long birth, but, as long as things were progressing, we were going to stay home. I checked out the nearby hospital in case there were problems, that we would Zoom there if we needed to, but I was able to have him at home. And so it was I was very fortunate to have that kind of experience, to have my child at home.
Yeah.
And to be working as a team with his dad. And, I'll always remember that. And, if another woman can't have that experience and something takes her to the hospital, no problem. Wonderful birthing rooms and all that. So I'm just happy that I was able to have that experience and no medication or anything like that and all that jazz. And so then you wanted me to mention, so then I have the baby, and what was such a shock to me, it's going to make me sound like, I sound like I was kind of with it until now as a kid in my thoughts. This took me totally by surprise, and it's the introduction to the book, or maybe I should just put that up online if my publisher lets me so people can read the introduction. I was totally taken by surprise. I had the baby, loved being a mom. But all my guy friends, and I've had mostly guy friends, would call and they'd say, hey, Jan, and they'd say, Jay is my guy's name. Hey, can Jay come out and ride? We rode mountain bikes a lot. Can Jay go skiing? And I'd go like, well, I don't know. Why don't you ask him? And then I'd hang up and I'd go, wow. Why didn't they ask me if I wanted to go skiing? They always did. And the big transition for me was the guys, as soon as there was a baby, they put me in a different category. I didn't. I could still ski. I could still bike.
Yeah.
And, I was doing it with the baby, but I could leave the baby for a little bit and go. My husband could have a little bottle of water or whatever. I could go for 1 hour when the baby's napping. And so I was very frustrated because it went on from there.
Yeah.
I did everything that the guys did and demanded in the guys' world, but the guys didn't come all the way into what I would call the girls' world.
Yeah.
And I found that frustrating. And that's when I started learning more about women and about these attitudes we've been talking about and needing that support to take that step and whatnot, because even now, girls and women outscore men all the way up through college academically, yet only 1% of the CEOs are women.
Yeah.
And, so that in the working world, the men are still paid more, the men still have higher level jobs, and it's still out of balance. There are enough women that I believe that would like and choose. I mean, we're natural managers.
Yeah.
Part of our hormone collection is to monitor and balance things. And there's data and statistics behind that. Women even read facial expressions better than men do, and this has been, there's data behind that. Wouldn't you be a better manager if you could read facial expressions on the people, you know, working for you?
Yeah.
So anyhow, that's a long answer, again, to your question. But that was my birthing experience, my pregnancy birthing experience, and then when I had the baby, how men looked at me.
Yes.
And what women are up against.
Yes, and I think that's still true. And sometimes, you know, even for ourselves, we can limit ourselves too. Although, honestly, I feel like, you know, I think there's so many choices available to us. I personally kind of put my career in second gear and worked at home. But then I became, you know, involved in other things like leading, you know, other activities and things. So I think there's so many choices available to women, and yet we need to make sure that we make our choice and don't let someone else
yes.
make it for us. I think that's
right.
that's part of it too, is what feels good for you and why, you know, what are your motivations? Back to even that, you know, where you talk about motivation in your book, you know, what is it you really want to do? How do you want to move forward? I see that
and
as so important.
I think that's important to for all of us, male or female, to look at, to look internally, to get those kinds of answers. Because just as you said, well, for about 20-ish years, you know, I was setting these records climbing and skiing,
yeah.
and then I had a baby. Well, I did children's books. I made a complete shift.
Yeah.
What's important now? What do I want to say? Different things became important when I had children, and I didn't want to be away for long periods of time on an expedition. To me personally, I'm not going to judge another woman if that's what she chooses to do.
Exactly.
But like you, I reveled in motherhood, and so I shifted what I did to be working out of my home and or taking my babies or my kids with me. And so that's when I did all of my children's books and my book, Mother and Child. And now my guys are older, 19 and 15. And so I'm getting back to some of the more far-flung things as they become independent.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's another, that is an important thing that you bring up as well, because I'm in the same, I only have one child who's 17 now, and I'm seeing the same thing happen, and I see it with many of the women around me, is that, you know, we have a lot of choices. I'm also seeing more men making the choice to be at home, or sometimes they don't make the choice. In this economy, I have seen so many men who, especially a few years ago, you know, suddenly found themselves at home, and I knew situations where, you know, it was easier for the wife to get a job, and, you know, so he stays at home with the kids, and you know what? That worked great. I have seen so many wonderful fatherhood situations, and if only we could willingly choose that if we want, and society
right.
still frowns on that, I think.
Yeah. Well, we need to be fair both ways.
Yes.
And we have even more options. If you look, you can find wonderful daycare, too,
you know,
and the right
That's
amount
true.
And at the right time for the child. You know, all of life is a balance, and we do know that. So.
Yeah, and I relied on part-time daycare so that I could work, because I was working as an engineer. I was actually doing, you know, my job. I was leading a project from home part-time, and sometimes I needed time, and so I put him, but he wasn't in there full-time, but I knew of good situations as well. You're right. There are so many choices.
Well, and here's one of the things I think is important. The last thing that I would say about that is what I would recommend to other women, though, even if your choice is to be home or you're throttling
yes.
back on work, I feel it's important for your own mind and potentially getting back to the workforce if you choose to. Whatever you're doing for work, it means something to you, and it helps you feel valued, and I think it's important to keep your hand in.
Yes.
I think going to a conference every now and then, or your certification, or whatever it is, I think making that effort to keep a hand in and know what's going on and keep up to a certain extent so you don't completely lose touch with what it was that made you tick earlier. I think that's important.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, I will say that part of my personal experience was getting involved with the parent-teacher organization. I eventually became president, although somewhat reluctantly, and then I embraced it. It was not the easiest thing to do at first, but I was so glad that I took on that opportunity because it later helped me. Even in when I came back, I went back into the workforce at one point, and it helped me. The fact that I'd been involved in leadership in a nonprofit volunteer role, and those things are meaningful. You use the same skills. I saw women all around me in those roles basically running a corporation. I mean, that's really what they were doing. They were, you know, between the finances and everything else. And I think we need to give ourselves credit, too, because sometimes that sort of thing is belittled. And yet, if you have the right people in industry who really care about experience, they do care. They do care about what you do as a volunteer. And there are a lot of opportunities out there, even for people, men who find themselves unemployed, both men and women.
I think that would be important for a guy to jump in and volunteer. That might make a difference in the next job that he applies for.
Yes.
Not only the skills he learned and how to get along and teamwork, but the fact that a company might say, well, he's a team player. He was volunteering. You know, let's take him.
Yes, yes. Well, I knew this interview would go by fast because there's just so much. There's so much in your book. You know, let's see if I can touch quickly.
Well, really jumped around a lot from one thing to the other to the other. But
it has a lot to it. You know, some of the things that really touched me, there's a story that you tell where you're at high altitude, and you tell a story that's about basically doing something for the greater good of all, is how I think you put it. Someone gives you his last bit of water.
Oh.
This is something a man who's on the expedition who looks, you know, he seems to be very giving and the connectedness that was reflected in that story, the teamwork and it goes beyond teamwork, the way you were connected.
Yeah, I know the story that you're talking about, and his name was Galen, and he's a wonderful guy, and this is when I set the women's high-altitude skiing record, and when you're up at about 25,000 feet, you have 50%, half the oxygen that you have at sea level. So your brain, I'm trying to set the scene here, your brain, your muscles, if they're getting half the gas they need. And at one point, we're with another man named Ned and me and Galen kept falling behind us, and we're reaching, you know, we're going towards the summit. It wasn't too technical at this point, but it was just a lot of arduous work. And he kept falling down, and you know, you have to stay together. You can't leave anyone behind. You're only as strong as it's like any chain. It's the weakest link is the strength of the chain. So I had some food in my pocket, and I gave it to him. You know, we'd been out. We'd left everything behind for hours. And after he had that, it was almost as if it was literally just fuel for his fire, and he perked up, and he was able to move ahead, and he was the one that went forward to reach the summit first. But on his way by me, he saw me retching. That happens a lot at high altitude.
Yeah.
You can just start throwing up anything you have. Just, you can imagine when you're sick, your body can't handle food. It's the same thing at high altitude. All that energy needs to go to your muscles, nothing in your stomach. You know, it can't be digested, so you throw it up. So he's going by me, and he says, wow, you don't look too good. You sure you want to go to the summit? And I'm like, yeah. And then I threw up on his skis. So he had just a little bit of water left, the only water that the three of us had, and he just handed it to me. So I explained that whole thing just to say that I didn't think about it at the time. This is me thinking again once we're down, because your brain is just doesn't have everything it needs to function.
Right.
But each of our reactions were to give the other one everything you had to help them make it. And I'm glad that we did that, because we made it. It was almost like there was no calculation. We didn't have enough oxygen in our brains to calculate things. It was just our natural reaction. Oh, you need food? Here's what I've got. Eat it. Oh, you need water? This is all that's left. Take it.
Yes.
And that's always remained in my mind to be an example of how important it is to really, it's an extreme example of teamwork, but, you know, teamwork.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost as if the word teamwork doesn't even quite capture it. It goes beyond. It is, though. I mean, it's just how we're all interrelated. And maybe this is a good point where we're in our last 5 minutes now, drawing to a close, is just the message of your work, and that, you know, we are all interrelated in that sense of harmony with each other and with the world itself. I'll give you an opportunity to just reflect in the final moments, and then also remind people where they can learn more about your work.
Well, I guess first I'd just say there's a website, janreynolds.com. All my books are up there, and I'd love it if people supported their local bookstores. So if you want High Altitude Woman or Mother and Child or any of the Vanishing Cultures series, it might cost you a little more, but it's great. If you can literally just go to your local bookstore and order them. Just tell them, you know, have them look up Jan Reynolds, and then they'll have the titles and can order them for you. But, you know, if you don't want to spend the money or support the store, you know, you make your choices, you can find them all on Amazon. So you can go to Amazon.com and order my books there. And so that's how you can find anything you need. And I have a blog. Let's see, what's that on Tumblr? So punch in Jan Reynolds on Tumblr if you want to follow some of what I do and my thoughts and comments. And I guess what I would say about the connection to other people, to the land and to the animals and to other people, I'd have to say our ancient selves, which would be the indigenous people, it was about as far back as I could walk in time, was to go to nooks and crannies on the planet to be with indigenous people that were still living the way they had been for hopefully the last 10,000 years anyway. And to probably because I grew up on a dairy farm too, where it's very obvious where your food comes from and you're connected to, we were a dairy farm, you know, raising and milking cows. That probably helped me connect with all these indigenous people, that it's so obvious that these people can't survive without each other. They need a healthy environment to survive and very often depend on their animals. And I just lived it. It's so evident that we need to honor and care for each other in our environments and the animals in them. It just was so smack you in your face with the things I've done. And it's more complicated for people in the modern world to really not just think it, but feel it on a visceral level. I think we need to feel it more than think it. Because today you could drive your car, you could order your groceries online, you can work in your cubicle. You could literally feel like you don't need anybody or anything. But that's a fallacy, because someone's growing that food you're eating, and someone's building that car you're driving, and you're working for someone in your cubicle. But we're just a few steps removed from that very visceral life that I had with indigenous people.
Yeah.
And I traveled on the salt route. I was working for National Geographic, and it's a 20,000-foot pass to go from Nepal to Tibet, and that's as high as Denali or McKinley in Alaska. So I'm working with these Tibetan salt traders, and I had a chance to experience what I call the brotherhood of barter, and had a chance to live and feel what it's like to not even use money. Money's only good to build a fire with. That what you have to give and to trade is what's valuable. And that's when you're so accepting of other people, that you open your life to other people, because it's just so evident that you need each other and you need to be on this trade route and trading so that you can survive, so that everyone can get the things that they need to survive. And that has shifted me and really allowed me, it was a gift and for me to be able to see how important it is to honor each other in the natural world.
Yes. Well, the live show's about to end. It goes into the podcast. But thank you so much, Jan, for being here today. I just want to tell the audience real quick, listening live, the next show is Monday, October 21st at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, with Frank Joseph returning. He's going to talk about his new book, The Lost Colonies of Ancient America. Just a quick announcement to the live audience. And once again, Jan, thank you so much for being here today. I'm really happy to learn more about your work, and I look forward to learning about some more of your books as well, because I think that you really have some powerful things to share with all of us, and I'm happy that you wrote about your detailed experiences, because they really are fascinating to enter into. So thank you for everything that you've done and are doing now.
Well, thanks for having me. It was an honor.
Well, likewise, it's a true honor to have you here. So I hope you have a wonderful afternoon, and once again, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
I'm just going to wrap up today's show really quickly for those of you listening in the podcast, because I know we're now dealing with the podcast audience. Welcome to you, by the way, those of you listening across time. There are no boundaries of time. I say this almost every time on this show because I want you to understand that your energy is very much live with us, and that's important. But I just want to remind everyone to learn more about upcoming shows as well as this show. I have it all written up on the website, frontierbeyondfear.com. That is the main website for this show. And you can access the entire archive there and also get a glimpse at the schedule. I've been adding shows to the calendar as they get scheduled, so you can look quite a ways out and then make a note of who you'd like to listen to live. And, of course, all of these shows are available as podcasts, both on the Blog Talk Radio site and on iTunes, and they're starting to get indexed from other services as well. So there are many, many ways for you to find this show, and I am just so thankful for the community around the show. Thank you so much for being here. I feel motivated today after having such an inspiring guest who's done such amazing things. I'm going to play a tune from Larry Sire, who wrote the Frontier Beyond Fear theme music. But I'm going to play a special song just in the podcast to close us out today. This is Nothing Impossible from Grammy Award winner Larry Sire.
Your universe.
True kindness.
Sprouting wings and flying.
Effortless health.
perpetual motion.
Self-discipline.
Open communication.
Family unity.
Time travel.
Clear visions.
Speed of light.
World at peace.
Nothing impossible. Nothing improbable.
Earth around the sun.
Wireless words.
Electricity.
Refrigeration.
Moving pictures.
Human genome.
Man in space.
Atomic particles.
We can't be alone.
We are not alone.
Thank you.